Yeah.
I was good at rooftop and snipe people. Or
Yeah.
the drive-by shooting, which is always some fun.
Welcome to the 19th episode of the Negative World Podcast, the one and only official podcast for the Negative World community, where we talk about mostly video games, and especially Nintendo video games. Yeah, we're recording this on the 20th of October. I am your passive-aggressive host, Guillaume. And with me today I have Anand.
That's right, my name is Anand, and Guillaume pronounced it correctly, which is good, because I was going to roast him over the coals if he didn't. My topic will be the necessity of video game media and journalism in today's modern age. And we also have...
I am Alaska Gamer, and my topic is going to be on action RPGs and the sort of failures that some games have in this hybrid genre.
Awesome. And I'm going to talk about... It's kind of ill-defined, my topic is, but... Yeah, I'm going to talk about basically like AI and in games and patterns and all of that good stuff. Mostly in old school games, but anyway, you'll see. We'll
you
talk
can just
about...
say it's ill because that's cool.
Oh yeah, sure. In the 90s, maybe. All right. So who wants to go first? Who wants to talk about a game that he's played?
Me.
I can talk about the... Okay.
Go for it. Because the day that we're recording this is my birthday. So,
okay,
yeah.
Yes, I was going to say that at the end, but sure. Happy birthday, Alaska Gamer.
Happy birthday.
Yep, 18 years old.
Woo-hoo.
Awesome.
Old enough to vote, but not enough to drink. But that's okay. I don't plan on drinking ever.
Yeah, drinking is overrated. Good for you. Straight edge.
Awesome.
Okay, but anyway, one game that I've been playing for the past couple weeks, I won't talk about right now, but we'll touch later on my topic, Alpha Protocol. Already you can see the connection if you know what that is. But the other big game that I have been playing is Aliens vs. Predator 2 for the PC. And what I can say about that game is, hey, do you like aliens?
Yes.
Who doesn't?
Do you like Predator?
No.
Kind of sucks.
It's scary.
Do you like a campaign that has a very dark and tense atmosphere?
Only if you can play the same levels three times.
Only if I play Bill Paxton.
Game over, man.
Then yeah, that pretty much sums up like the three different campaigns. You know, if you like aliens, you'll enjoy playing as the alien, and to an extent, you'll enjoy the Marine campaign because it's, for the most part, basically like an aliens type story. You know, you're the Marines. You got pulse rifles and smart guns.
Awesome. And like sonic detectors or whatever they're called.
The motion trackers, yeah. Which are total crap because they cannot detect anything vertically. But yeah, like Aliens vs. Predator 2. The thing about that game is before now I'd actually played it once. It was like several years ago, so I was a lot younger and maybe I was probably too young to have played it at all, but it's the game that kind of like introduced me to like both of the Alien and Predator franchises.
Really?
Yeah. So like I was like back in elementary school, like some people used to know and like visit and play video games, and one of them I forget who had the game is there, and it looked interesting. Played the Marine campaign. Went through the first level up until you face your first couple of aliens, and I turned it off because by that point I was too scared. but then I found that the alien campaign was a lot of fun because you were the monster that was scaring everyone instead of being the one scared. And
nice. this game actually came out, like, when did it come out?
It came out 2001. Like so,
oh, so it's not
so
the
it's
recent
like,
one.
No, it's not the recent one. And it's like this one was like made by Monolith, Nolan List Forever guys. And
but wasn't like I'm surprised that it was this recent because like I thought that the game was on the Jaguar.
That's
the
Aliens vs. Predator
game?
1, I think. It was like the one good Jaguar game or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's like actually like the thing behind the Aliens vs. Predator video games that they were, with the exception of AVP2, they were developed by Rebellion. They made the Jaguar game and they made the PC game. And then, like, the recent one is what they made. So, like, there was reason there for some hype because, you know, it's the original creators of that type of game coming back to it. But then, of course, you realize, oh, yeah, their track record hasn't been that great recently. But anyway, that game is still pretty good. Like, the only problems I'm having right now is when I'm trying to add the official, like, patches from Sierra because the executables, like, won't run in Windows 7 64-bit. So I have to kind of play it like in its unpatched version, and I can't. And I'm not able to access the multiplayer if I wanted to. But yeah, I've been playing a lot of that game. I finally had the courage to get through the Marine campaign. I just basically didn't have the volume up so loud, and every time that I had to go through like a ventilation shaft, like at the beginning level, I just took a deep breath and just ran.
I'm kind of curious. Like when you're playing as a human, do you often find yourself accidentally shooting at cats that jump out of the shadows?
No, but I remember like when I first played it, there's a sort of environmental scare early on in the game where like a steam pipe bursts down from the ceiling, and like the first time you see you know like looking at the box cover of it and things, like I already knew what to expect, what the aliens look like. Okay, they have a very long tubular looking head with which like nowadays I would say a giant
phallic
penis head.
Yeah,
a giant penis head. Like, at that time, I didn't know. Again, I was, like, 10. But, like, when it comes down, like, it's curved, and you need to think, oh, crap, an alien. And I literally, like, shot pulse rifle bullets at a broken steam pipe that burst down from the ceiling. That was pretty good. That got me well. But...
And then you're walking down a hallway, and a bunch of aliens burst in through the window?
No, not exactly. You just like activate like a security system and like lights turn on, but that wakes up the aliens inside and they come after you.
I bet that at some points, like soldiers from like the corporation or something are trying to stop you from killing them all.
Exactly. Well, actually, not so much kill them, but they're trying to like keep you from like leaving the planet alive, knowing that the situation there has gone bad. Because like there are like some like corrupt corporate soldiers there that don't take that aren't very fond of the Marines.
Well, at least it seems to be like faithful to the mythos of the franchise.
Yeah, oddly joint mythos of. Isn't it weird how those things are always like joined together somehow? It's like peanut butter and chocolate, Aliens and Predator.
Yeah, that's the best part that I can say about Aliens vs. Predator 2. Like, you know, obviously there was the first game before that, but if you look at the campaigns in the first game, the one Rebellion's made, the campaigns are completely separate. They're like their own stories. This one, all these campaigns are running concurrently with each other, and they interweave with each other really well. Especially because, well, the campaigns come together like at the halfway point, and they kind of like split off again, but they're still in the same timeline on the same planet. As the alien, for example, you are at the start of the incident that would call in the Marines. You know, like that's how it always happens. And as the Marines, you are the ones that have been called there to deal with the situation.
I'm glad that game developers have finally learned to deal with multiple points of view then.
Actually, the multiplayer in those games seems pretty interesting because it's like you can have a totally different play experience depending on what race you pick, right?
Yeah, like not only is there like the different races, but in multiplayer, there are like multiple classes for each race. There's like four for each race. But in, like... there are actually four sides, you know. You would think there's the Marines, there's the aliens, and then the Predators. But then the fourth race in multiplayer are the corporates, which are like the enemy human soldiers that you fight as the Marine. And they're basically the same, you know, they just have different armor and stuff.
Do they have like suits and a briefcase and they throw papers at you?
No, they're they're basically like hired mercenaries.
Oh,
you know, like their
lawyers, lawyer attack. Like the I think the recent one had a multiplayer demo on Xbox Live, and I tried it because I was intrigued. And then I had my usual 1% kill to death ratio, and I was like, "Fuck this game! Fuck online games!"
And like, and I even have like the new Aliens vs. Predator game. Like, it's all right. Like, there are things that I kind of don't like, but I was turned off initially when there was like sort of like bad reviews and mixed critical reception coming out. So, like after waiting a year and a half and checked it out when it was $5 on Steam during that Sega sale, it was like it's all right. Except, you know, like the Marine campaign isn't scary at all, and the focus jump for the Predator that allows him to easily jump onto tree branches works really well, and the Alien campaign has no real satisfying conclusion.
Maybe they'll just make a Predator platforming game next time, and it'll just be the good parts.
You know, with like Batman, Arkham City, Arkham Asylum, like those games, like doing really well, like the sort of sneaking around and taking out enemies one by one. That sort of gameplay works well with the Predator when you think about it.
He is kind of like a Predator, yeah.
Yeah.
True. And he even had that night vision, which Batman doesn't actually have in real life, that allows him to see through walls.
Yeah.
Which Batman doesn't actually have in real life.
Yeah, real life. He exists, baby. You better believe it.
Yeah, and of course, like Batman, the Predator has tons of weapons and gadgets.
Does he? The Predator? Is he dumb or is he actually like sentient? He is pretty smart, right?
He is sentient, you know, because like the whole thing behind the aliens versus Predator like mythos is that the Predators, they've hunted aliens and that they're the most challenging game. But like the Predator has like multiple weapons. You know, they got a spear. They got, you know, they got the iconic shoulder cannon with like the three dots for aiming. And then they got like a spinning razor disc that acts as a boomerang. And then they've got a little plasma pistol, a spear gun, a net gun, all kinds of stuff.
That's an action game waiting to happen. But it's too bad that the world's most dangerous game is no longer man. Those aliens have taken everything from us.
Okay, ready to move on to the next game? I've been pretty busy playing for the retro game club that we're doing. I've been playing Rondo of Blood, Castlevania, the Castlevania game that was for the PC Engine CD. That we never got over here, that got a great reputation because people who could import it were saying, like, oh my god, it's the best Castlevania ever. Or maybe just like Jeremy Parrish on 1UP.
But, no, I think a lot of people thought it was the best. I have to interject here on behalf of Game Dad Grant and say that it did come to the SNES as Castlevania X.
That's not really, it's not the same game though.
Yeah, it's not the same.
PC Engine, like, weren't like the old Toho games on that or something, or am I getting it confused?
The PC Engine is basically what the TurboGrafx was called in Japan, and that's all it is. So basically, like, we do have the system. It's just, yeah, it's a Super Famicom and SNES scenario again. But yeah, Rondo of Blood, like, it's actually a pretty kick-ass game. Like, I know that came out after the SNES one, Castlevania 4. In that game, like, you could throw your whip in 8 different directions, and like, it made a lot of improvements like that. Like, your character was more mobile. And when you go to Rondo of Blood, like, they took a little bit of a step back. You can no longer, like, whip overhead or, you know, only straight ahead. But they have improved the mobility, you know. Like, you can jump on and off stairs, which is a huge help. Like, seriously, like, it's huge improvement that cannot be overstated. And basically, like, the game's presentation is outstanding. You start out, you're playing Chapter Zero, you get attacked by Death. He wants something, but you don't understand because he's talking in Japanese.
That's a pretty good start, though, getting greeted by Death at the beginning.
Yeah, isn't the Symphony of the Night is like that too, kind of, right? It's the end of Rondo of Blood, right?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, Rondo of Blood, you just, unless you understand German and Japanese.
German?
Yeah, the game is not translated at all, but you don't really need it. Like, who cares, really?
Yeah.
I know that the story became, like, kind of an important part in the Metroidvania games, but I don't know, I never really cared. Yeah, and, like, you're always just, like, saving your girlfriend. Like, who cares? But yeah, like, amazing intro. Like, you're on, it's raining, there's thunder, you're just driving this cart, and Death attacks you, and then, you know, burning village, you go through it, and like, it's just very, very lots of elements in the background. Like, the enemies will always kind of be foreshadowed, you know, like you see Death appear for the first time. There's like a strike of lightning, and you see the silhouette in the background, and then, you know, he appears in front of you. Other monsters do that most of the time, you know, like, you'll see a full moon in the background, and
werewolf.
It's pretty, yeah, it's pretty easy to guess that it's the shape of a werewolf, and then, you know, he jumps into the screen. But yeah, like, pretty cool stuff like that. And what's really, really good also is that there's really, like, you feel almost like the world of Castlevania is a real place. You know, there's a logical progression. You know, you go through the forest on your cart and you arrive at the village, and then you go through the catacombs or whatever, and then the chapels, and like, you reach the castle, and you can feel that you're climbing up, you know, and you're going always deeper into this castle.
Everything's seamlessly connected in a way.
Yeah, because like when you think of other, you know, a Super Mario game, there's no connection really. It's really a series of levels.
I think maybe a connection would almost hold it back, kind of like Super Mario Sunshine, maybe, you know, in a Mario game.
Yeah, it's like in a Mario game, it's like, oh, I go through the door, now I'm in the fire level. You're in the next it's the ice level.
I mean, like, how could you have like a logical way to get to Giant World or, you know, something like that? I guess there's
that's paintings. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that really there's no point in making Mario feel like more like an actual place, but in Castlevania it plays a pretty good role in, you know, the building the mood and the atmosphere.
It's got this like, sort of story that it has.
It almost sounds kind of like Ghouls and Ghosts, like where it has that overworld map and it seems like you're kind of progressing on your way to something.
Oh yeah, there's always, in Castlevania, there's always a map showing you when you go from one level to the next, and it doesn't really add anything to the game. I mean, like, it's not like you can get lost. You always go forward. But it actually helps, you know, show you, like, yep, you're making your way from here to there, and you're always getting closer to your goal.
Like the Indiana Jones map or something. Yeah, even the original Castlevania had that, the NES one, I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. That brings me to my second game that I've been playing, the NES Castlevania game.
Segway.
You used to hate that game, right?
Well, hate is a strong word. Basically, I didn't really care for it. Maybe I was too young when I started playing it, but like it seemed very brown, very uninteresting.
it was the brown game before every game nowadays is brown.
It was very earth-toned.
It was the precursor to brown games of the 21st century.
At that time, though, it was like unique in that way because everything else was like blue and green.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was the hipster of brown games.
Because, like, when you think of Ghouls and Ghosts, I mean, like, that's kind of a colorful world. Like, sure, it's dark and there's, like, tombs everywhere, but the, you know, red demons and you're boxers or... It's very lighthearted. Oh, like, Castlevania is completely different.
Running around in your underwear.
Ghouls and Ghosts is all primary colors. I love that series.
Yeah, but, like, basically, that game... I guess maybe I was too young to really appreciate it. And now I go back to it and I realize that a lot of those foggy memories that I had about it were a little bit inaccurate. You know, like I remembered the controls being really, really stiff. And sure, like you're not controlling Mario here, but it's still like it feels good. And the your abilities are good enough for, like, they are good enough to face the challenges.
Except when you get hit by Medusa in mid-jump.
yeah, but you can, like, the patterns of...
Yeah, right.
Oh, wait, we're getting into my topic. But yeah, the patterns of the Medusa heads are predictable, so you can't avoid it. But another thing that struck me, though, is that while I was playing, I realized that perhaps Rondo of Blood is not... its presentation is not that amazing because it's the exact same freaking thing. Castlevania on the NES is, like, the same feeling of progression, the same feeling that you're in an actual place. Yeah, and you get, like, the map showing you your progress and, like... But the areas are the same.
And the music's already pretty awesome.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. And it would become, like, remade... For you know, like 13 games or however there are. But yeah,
in other words, sequels.
Yeah, they almost feel sometimes like remakes because, like...
I think the first Super Nintendo one is a remake, isn't it? Castlevania 4?
Do you play as Simon? I don't know. Is it even important? Like, even if you're not playing as Simon Belmont...
I'm pretty sure it's a Belmont regardless.
Well, yeah, that's the story of those games.
There are multiple people in the Belmont family that are the stars.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense because the games in Japanese, like, they're called Dracula's Castle, right? And Castlevania is just a stupid made-up word, but...
Dracula's Curse, isn't it? Or something?
Ah, you might be right. But, yeah, no, basically, it's just, like, the game, the original game was so in advance of its time, I guess, and, like, so... It would be the template that every other game would follow except Simon's Quest. In a way, like, that kind of... Playing it now, like, it makes the its sequels feel less impressive, and I don't know, but I really, really enjoyed the NES game, and I really recommend people to go check it out, especially since, like, it's going to be, like, Halloween soon, So if you haven't played it, if you're scared that it's too difficult, like, it's really not. Like, on the VC, you get the save state thing. Like, you're going to be fine.
I'll just play Aliens vs. Predator 2 on Halloween. That'll be my scary game.
Sure.
Yeah, like, Castlevania, that was one of those games where it was one of the first NES games I have, and it's just like, you know, somebody tells you about it, and you're like, wow, you can fight all that stuff, and there's Dracula and all this stuff, and the mummy, and, you know, you just hear about it, and it's like a can't-miss concept, you know? So, I mean, to me, the concept almost, it's a good game, but it was just so strong, even though it seems so generic now. At the time, it was like just a bolt of lightning, you know? And I always, like, really liked that series. And Simon's Quest was actually, that was in the age when sequels could be totally different, you know? To a certain extent, like Zelda 2 and Mario 2 and things like that. But Castlevania NES is still a fun game. I got the GBA version of it, and I still enjoyed that. Although the old NES cart, like, it used to crash every time I got to the last level, which just, you know, caused an unbelievable amount of frustration in my youth, but still.
Wow. What a nightmare.
Yeah. Right.
Did you ever end up beating it?
No, it just fucking pissed me off so much. Every time I got to Dracula, it would crash. I think I beat it one time.
You're going to be like buying it on the virtual console, and you're going to get to the last level, and it's going to crash.
And then I will break my Wii over my
Go
knee.
Go through all that torture again.
Yeah, but yeah, basically that's what I had to say about Castlevania. Check it out. Yeah, go for it.
I've been playing not that much, but a couple things. One of them is Nintendogs 3DS, which is a game that I don't think many people have talked about. And I guess there's not that much to say about it, but, you know, I think it's a pretty interesting concept, and it still works pretty well. Basically, it's like...
With cats.
What'd you say? Yeah, with cats. Yeah. The funny thing is that I haven't even bought a cat yet, because I'm just so focused on winning all the competitions with my dogs. But, yeah, so, like, you just play a little bit every day, and you there's, like, a crafting system. So you find junk on the road, and you can recycle it into stuff like a piano, like a functional piano, or like a helicopter, or, you know, a voucher for... or what?
If only the world functioned like that. Just pick up
stuff,
turn it into better stuff.
Exactly. That's a Dead Rising 2. No, but the, you can also get a robo-dog, which I just unlocked, which is the hardest thing to unlock. It was a little disappointing, because, he behaves pretty much the same as a normal dog. You still have to feed him, and his poop isn't metal or anything like that. But and he doesn't even seem that fast or anything. So that was kind of disappointing. But,
yeah,
you know, I put a lot of time into that game, like an embarrassing amount of time into it, just a little bit every day. And I think it really, you know, it does what it wants to do very well, I think. You just play a little bit every day, it'll last you maybe like a couple months or something like that, and then you're done with it. But I think it's worth buying if you're interested in that sort of virtual pet experience. It has some AR stuff, too, which is kind of annoying. But they also have, like, a functional Mario Kart that you can drive around.
That's cool.
Things like, yeah, it has a lot of cool unlockable things like that. So and, like, a musical instrument and just kind of things like that. So I think it's a pretty neat game. It has records that you can unlock. So there's not that much to say about that. But I would suggest people who have any interest at all to maybe try it out or something, because I think it's a pretty worthwhile title for the 3DS just to have. It'd be better as downloadable, maybe. And then the other game I've been playing is It's Space Bust-a-Move. Do you guys like the Bust-a-Move series?
I tried the WiiWare version, and that's the only version I've tried. And I played it by myself, so it wasn't really that interesting.
Yeah,
I'm sure I played one of those games at some point, but I don't remember which one or when.
All right. It's sort of a match three, but it's a little bit different than Tetris or something, because you're shooting stuff, you know, up instead of stuff falling down.
Yeah.
But I've always liked the series, and it's one of the series that in college... I used to just skip class and go play Police Trainer and Bust a Move. Like, just endlessly. Like, it was like 60% of my college experience. And on the Neo Geo cabinet and stuff like that. But it's a pretty fun series, and, you know, it's kind of up or down. And Space Bust a Move is the latest DS version. I think there have been three DS versions. The first one, you know, you can use the touchscreen like a catapult. And the second one was just a normal one made by Majesco. And so this third one uses the Taito paddle. This is a Taito game, so it uses the DS paddle. Do you guys know about that?
No.
Basically, you plug it into the Game Boy Advance port, and it's like a paddle, just like the old paddle games in the arcade and stuff. And it works with Arkanoid DS, which is one of the worst Arkanoid games ever. It works with it's horrible. It's so shitty. And it works with Space Invaders Extreme and Space Invaders Extreme 2. And it also works with Space Bust-a-Move. And of those, they're all good except for Arkanoid, which it really goes to show, like, you wouldn't think of, like, level design when you think of a puzzle game, but It's so bad, Arkanoid, and just all the mechanics are so bad. And Space Bus to move, it's actually really good, and it's almost like a sort of mental puzzle at times. And the paddle, if you import it from Japan, which you have to, you have to import it from somewhere like that. Yeah, it's not even documented that it supports.
I don't have a regular DS to use it on. So
yeah, that's the problem. See, because I bought that paddle, I don't want to sell my DS Lite now. If it wasn't for that, I would have no problem whatsoever just getting rid of it. Yeah, just like Kirby's Tilt and Tumble didn't allow me to sell my shitty old Game Boy Advance first generation. This paddle is gonna weigh me down with a DS Lite with broken hinges and non-functional L and R buttons.
That's how they get you to not sell the stuff.
I know. But it's a really great version of the game, and it's just full of tons of modes. And using the paddle on it, it makes it really fun. Like, it allows you to have a very high degree of control, and that kind of paddle control is the kind of thing that you can't really replicate with any other scheme. You know, I mean, when you try, it's usually just kind of janky. And I almost wish the 3DS came with like an onboard paddle or something, because, you know, it's just fun to play with those kind of things. And the paddle itself, it feels pretty good. It's not as heavy as I would like, but it's a really good game. And even if you don't have a paddle, I'd recommend spending the $20 or something to pick it up, because it's just chock full of modes, and it's got like unlockables and all that shit. And it's just really just a great puzzle game that I don't know if anyone knows about. And
I'm kind of curious about the paddle, though. Like, do you feel that you can develop like a muscle memory to know exactly where you're going to be shooting?
Well, have you ever used like a paddle game, like with any experience?
Not really, no.
Yeah, I mean, like, paddles are it's a much more fine control way to control those kind of games, right? Something like Kaboom back.
It's the sort of control mechanism that will work in something like Bit-Trip-Beat.
It would totally, it's built for that kind of stuff, like Bit-Trip-Beat. The thing about a paddle is, like, if you want to get somewhere fast, you can just spin the paddle for a while. If you want a very fine degree, you can just move it a little. You know, yeah, you have total control of it once you get used to it. So it's a very interesting mechanic that there's no way to replicate it with current systems, and I think it's really interesting. Yeah. Like WarioWare Twisted was cool for similar reasons, right? It was interesting, unique, and they could do interesting things with it. And I think it would be an interesting thing to bring back, because you can't deal with Kinect, and you can't really do it with the Wiimote, you know, so. Yeah. But I would suggest that people get that. Actually, Taito, you know, they've had kind of a comeback of late with the Space Invaders Extreme and all the downloadable games and Space Bus to Move. I think their games have been really good, actually, ever since they've been bought by Square Enix, oddly enough. And this one was made by Landcars, which I think also made Legend of Kage 2 and maybe Etrian Odyssey or something. So, I don't know. Pretty interesting.
Cool.
or maybe not, depending on your... But I would recommend it. It's $20, and nobody bought it, and you should buy it. Space Bus. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'll buy the paddle and just set it in my room and not touch it. My topic, as I mentioned earlier, is going to be on action RPGs, and the game I will be using as an example will be Alpha Protocol. Now, as for if you're wondering, like, what exactly do I mean when I say RPG, action RPGs, because of how nebulous and up in the air most genres are,
sure.
You listening to this, figure it out on your own. I'm not gonna bother explaining. It was.
No, you have to define it, otherwise you can't.
No, but what I want to say is that, like, Alpha Protocol is a Western RPG, right? Like, I mean, and so you're not talking about stuff like Secret of Mana. Like, you're talking about an actual RPG.
I'm talking about action RPGs, primarily made by developers who have been known for making old RPGs on the PC. And have had
that
to
is a
make
specific
games,
and have category.
Had to make their and have had to make their games to for consoles as well, because the market for PC exclusives isn't quite there anymore.
Right.
Yeah, I've been playing a lot of Alpha Protocol, and You know, like the easiest thing you can say about that game, about what it's like, is, hey, it's like Mass Effect, except instead of being set in space in the future, it's modern day espionage spy stuff. You know?
Okay, but more specifically, like it's actually an RPG where you can you have tons of choices. You can everything that you do can affect the game world. And
I thought the setting was really pretty interesting. I mean, it's not really unique, but in the world of video games, it is kind of.
Yeah, sure. Like you're a spy, and like you can talk about to arms dealers, and like you can kill them. But if you kill them, you won't be able to buy weapons from them. And
it almost seems too good to be true. Like too good to be like a balanced, polished game.
Well, I'll get to that in a second, but one thing I'll say is, this is, as far as I've seen, very common of Obsidian and games. Their games have great stories, they got really good writing and characters, and then you play them and you realize that they're underwhelming. Alpha Protocol's gameplay, mainly the part where you are in combat and have to shoot dudes, is the not-so-fun part.
Is it less fun than, a turn-based battle system would be, though?
Is it that's sort of the thing. Like, I guess I should go and make one distinction about what I think constitutes as an action RPG instead of a regular RPG. Action RPGs is the emphasis on the action, the sort of direct control of a character. Like in the case of Alpha Protocol, is a third-person shooter. You control
you
a
mean
dude
during combat, right? Basically,
yeah. You hold a button to aim. You press another button to shoot. Whereas if it was in an old school RPG, it would be you're in a sort of in a battle screen, and you would select the menu that is attack, and then you would go through another menu to select which guy to attack. You know,
I'm getting chills just thinking about it.
That's old school RPG. This is action RPG, whereas you are controlling one character and one character alone, and you are basically directly controlling the actions. But the problem is that the action parts are completely governed by old RPG mechanics and dice rolls, which is really bad for the shooting because, you know, GoldenEye has made me like this. I instinctively aim for the head of every person I see. And, you know, you don't even have a traditional crosshair. It's just a big circle with a little dot in the middle, but even the bullets won't even go there. They'll always go within the range of the circle.
But isn't that more realistic? And otherwise it wouldn't be an RPG, right?
Well, no, it's not more realistic. The problem is that if you don't have good statistics for shotguns, you could be right next to the guy, you're going to shoot him in the face, and you're going to miss because
distance isn't really a big determining factor. It's more even if I'm up close to someone, there have been situations where I'm not even aiming at a person's head. I'm right up close. Basically the ring is pretty much all over a big part of their body, and yet a bullet still misses.
You know, Blizzard said something about Diablo. They were saying that just make sure whatever you do that you're always powerful, so you're always competent, and then the powers just make you more and more competent. So I think if they did it like that, where you could functionally hit somebody, but you would just be more, you know, better and better with the powers, that might be kind of interesting. But I can see how it'd be frustrating also.
I mean, if there were if there were better visual cues that told you when you're, if your aiming is getting worse from continual fire, that's sort of fine. Another game I'll use briefly as an example, the original Deus Ex. That is a game that is doesn't go to the same depths of RPG mechanics as Alpha Protocol, but it falls into the same trap with the shooting, where it's governed by dice rolls. And
yeah, exactly.
And when you're shooting the gun, the animation for shooting it is so stiff, and there's no real indicator of you've been firing too much, your aiming is all screwed up, you're not holding the gun steady anymore. It's
even those hack and slash games like Baldur's Gate and stuff like that, like the overhead ones, they were kind of irritating because you would play an action game, but then you would just miss when you're right in front of the guy, and that's always kind of irritating.
The thing that's sets a game like Baldur's Gate apart from something Alpha Protocol or Mass Effect, if we're going to compare BioWare games to their to other BioWare games, is that the way that you control characters in Baldur's Gate is different than you control Commander Shepard in Mass Effect.
Because you don't have direct control, so it's more irritating when you miss when you shouldn't have?
Yeah, And it's like, you know, like even though like in something like Diablo, even though you're controlling one character only, you know, it's hard for me to like count it as an action RPG in the same vein, because you're still controlling a person like with a mouse, and you're clicking on a dude to make your character go through his attack animation.
Right. Like, don't you think though that games like Alpha Protocol and Mass Effect, like they're only isn't their sin really that they're too much like an RPG and they look too much like a shooter? Because is there actually anything wrong with the RPG mechanics?
When there's the transition from Mass Effect 1 to 2 gameplay wise, Mass Effect 2 addresses that, and you can argue in many ways that Mass Effect 2 is a better game. I'll say it is. But that's at the expense of like of cutting out way too many RPG elements and stuff, like simplifying it so much that during, I think, one of BioWare's presentations, might have been at GDC or something, like it was titled, "Dude, Where's My Inventory?" Because they completely took out the inventory in Mass Effect 2. Whereas
that stuff is like a pain in the ass, though, isn't it, though?
Well, yeah, but having a big inventory and stuff is kind of like something that is like part of an RPG to begin with. You know, it's that loot. Like, there's a loot aspect to RPGs, but you think it would have been smarter for them to make a better designed inventory menu than just completely take it out.
Yeah, like, but I wonder how possible it is when you have all that sort of choice of items and stuff like that.
Yes, and that's kind of like the problem, you know, because the whole thing with this action RPG is that it's a whole genre that I think is a genre of compromises, because you've got two groups of people, you know, they're the people who are coming at it because they look at it as a cool action game, you know, the people who like the third-person shooters, like the character action games, stuff like that. Then you've got the RPG people who, like, really enjoy having their games, like, all stat-driven. They like their games to have attributes and skill trees and all that other stuff. And
I think as long as developers can suck in the first group, they don't really care about the second group.
Yeah. In the case of Mass Effect 1, like, that leaned for the most part like in the RPG area. And then 2, like, addressing like the problems with the action, the criticisms, they tried to fix up the action and made it play like a regular third-person shooter, but that was at the compromise of oversimplifying like the RPG mechanics. It's just, you know, it's everything that people complain about when they're like talking about how they love those old RPGs and stuff. You know, like they love, you know, like System Shock 2 is a great action RPG. They love Morrowind. People are like Mass Effect 1. They like Dragon Age Origins, and then they always complain about like games that come out after it.
Watered down.
Yeah,
made a good point about two kinds of gamers, because I like action games a lot and I don't like RPGs at all, and that's why action RPGs kind of bug me, because it seems like the RPG elements just sort of just water down the action elements and make it so that it's often too easy, or you can game the system too much. And I guess it's good because it means that, like in a Castlevania game, that everybody can theoretically beat the game as long as they grind long enough, but I don't think that's really good for balance, and it bugs me when I'm playing an action game. I prefer to play something that's perfectly, you know, tailored and balanced to one sort of experience. And
yeah, that's basically what we talked about in like the third episode of the podcast.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
But
that's been a problem throughout history. Like, even in the 16-bit, 8-bit days, action RPGs, it's really almost impossible to hit that balance of being a good action game and having satisfying RPG elements, if you consider RPG elements things like leveling, stuff like that, instead of story, which, you know, you could theoretically inject into it.
Yeah. I'm moving briefly away from the action RPGs, like from like the Western developers, to over in Japan, a little game called Dark Souls, and a game before Demon's Souls. From what I've read about it and looked at it, and especially looking at speedruns of that of those games, is that, you know there are the traditional RPG elements. You know, you got different attributes and stuff that you can like assign points to and that kind of stuff as you level up. But the thing is that pretty much all the different enemies and challenges in that game follow the principle of, if you can hit it, if you can attack it and do damage to it, you can kill it eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those games are super punishing, but you can, like, if you're persistent enough and really good and on your toes, you can like take down a boss that is like way that you are way underprepared for, and still beat it just by rolling around, taking hits, and getting out of the way.
That's actually awesome, yeah.
Like, you saw, like, speed runs and stuff, so these guys probably didn't get hit too much, but, like, it isn't a problem with those games. Well, I say a problem, but it's actually kind of, I find it a refreshing feature. But, like, when you die, like, don't you start over, but with a penalty? And so, like, the whole point is kind of, like, in most games, you get to try, you know, like, what's trial and error, right? Like, you get to try, die, and then try again, and you win.
I'm not talking specifically about the penalties. Yeah, those are there. Like, that's purely that. But I'm talking about mainly how it handles the parts where there are traditional RPG elements and where it plays as an action game.
Yeah, the swordplay is actually like an action game, right?
Yeah, like, the think about people who do the three hard runs in Legend of Zelda games, and people that, like, don't get any of the, energy tank upgrades in the Metroid game. Like, you know, like, you know, with, like, enough skill, you can basically, like, just get through without having to, like, you know, go back someplace to get, like, a little upgrade to make you more powerful or more resistant to attacks.
I mean, actually, like, I was playing Devil's Advocate earlier when I was talking about RPG elements and missing the guy that you're shooting at, but nothing bugs me more in a game than that. And, like, the kind of action RPGs that I like Earth Defense Force, you could say, is an action RPG because it's basically a third-person shooter, but you can upgrade your weapons and stuff, like, to a crazy degree. Or Monster Hunter, which I have to bring up every podcast. Like, Monster Hunter Tri is, like, yeah, that's, like, the definition of an action RPG because it's really a balls-out action game, you know? And any enemy can kill you.
With very deliberate animations.
Yeah, but it's just like Dark Souls, right? Or Demon Souls, from what I understand of it. It's like, you know what your abilities are and your movements are, and you know what the enemies are, and you can kill anything, but anything can kill you on a bad day, you know?
Yeah.
And you can kind of better your odds, but that's always...
Like those games, you know, they got the heavy RPG elements, but to an extent, they allow you to do a lot on the action side of things and let it still feel fair, where, like, at that point, you know, like, to a point, you know, like, having your stats high enough is crucial, but but you're still able to, like, beat a certain enemy or boss with enough reflexes without having to resort to something like grinding, which
yeah,
I do not
that's
like.
That's the important thing, that grinding is, like, if you ever need to grind in an action RPG,
It's inherent to the design and there's, like, some reward for it, like loot, so
there's always reward for it though, right?
Yeah, but, like, in something like Diablo, you know, that's really, like, when you boil it down, it's just a big grind fest with, like, the dangling carrot in front of you that is, like, the next piece of loot. And
that's true, but, like, that's all the game is, right? It's basically, like, like, loot fest.
But, yeah, so, like, in games where it's, like, you know, they don't really convey to you that, you know, you might have to grind at some point because, oh, you just hit a boss and you keep getting destroyed every time. Like, that is, like, kind of almost burned me out on RPGs a couple times. But, yeah.
That's the most broken thing ever. Like, especially in a turn-based RPG when you have no chance to defend yourself. It's just like, why am I playing? Why did the developer do this to me? Like, I don't want to waste my time with this game.
Yeah. And that's where the action RPGs come in, where it tries to address that. But even then, they always, like, step on the toes of, like, one group in favor of another.
Do they always, though? I mean, like,
It feels like that whenever I look at discussions about the different games. Like,
which games do you guys think do it the best?
Like, I think, like, Dark Souls and Demon Souls are kind of, like, the closest to doing that pretty well, because it allows you to, like, despite the punishing conditions, it still allows you to, like, to beat something even if your stats are not, like, at the recommended level.
Mm-hmm. Personally, like, are we going to call Fallout 3 an action RPG? I'm going to stick with my theory that the problem with Alpha Protocol is that it's an RPG that's disguised in an action game, and, like, you know, like, it has no It shouldn't be. Like, the action thing is just, it's not actually an action game.
Yeah.
And it just looks like one, and it's tricking you into thinking it's an action game.
It just wants to trick people into buying it, right?
Well, that's like where the majority of people who play video games, like, that's where their interest is in, especially here on the Western side of the world, you know?
Yeah, sure, but, like, they're going to buy it, or they're not going to buy it in the case of Alpha Protocol.
Yeah, it's true. Nobody bought it still.
People who are fans of games like XCOM and Syndicate are complaining about their favorite games, like, being made into first-person shooters, but... That's like where like most of the audience lies. There's not enough of those people around, which is unfortunate. I mean, like if Alpha Protocol was made in the style of like those old like Infinity Engine games, you know, like Baldur's Gate or the stuff that Black Isle Studios made, like Icewind Dale, or
it would be right at home.
Yeah, exactly. That priority on stats and like some dice rolls, whether or not you like it, it's at least a bit more justified there than it is in a game that plays like a third-person shooter.
Yeah, like because when I play Alpha Protocol, like I can recognize that it's an RPG because I played them before. But like someone who's only played shooters and you know takes a shotgun to some guy's face and misses, like he's not going to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's really the flaw. And like what I find good about Fallout 3 is like the whole VATS system that gave you action points basically, and you could just like stop the action, aim at crotch, shoot. And, you know, like you could see the percentages and how much damage it would cause. Like that adds one more layer of RPG to the game, but that's just more honest in a way.
Yeah, even when you don't have enough action points to use VATS, you're going to have to put up with bad dice roll shooting like every time.
Do you guys think RPGs could ever really be mass market though? I mean, like when Final Fantasy came out, if they actually showed the gameplay of the battles in the commercial, you know, or if they showed like for Morrowind or Oblivion the actual sword fights, I can't imagine people would buy them, you know, if they actually knew what the. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's like you know, the thing that you brought up about like Morrowind and Oblivion with the combat is pretty interesting because
it's so shitty. I mean, it's like terrible.
Yeah, especially Morrowind, and I like Morrowind. Everything else I like about it except the combat because of the bad same three animations, like overhead slice, sideways slice, and then stab. And it's
and
also
the lack of collision, like with the enemies, and it just seems so amateurish. And I don't know if anyone would sign up for that without being bamboozled into it by seeing like.
Yeah, and even though Oblivion's combat is also bad, like if you come off from Morrowind disappointed in that, you're at least made tolerable of the combat in Oblivion. and it also like turned out that Oblivion also had like some stats and some complex things from Morrowind taken out. So that's another example of people complaining about sequels to their favorite games being dumbed down for mass market.
And then Skyrim. Take it even further.
Yeah, I mean, like attributes, I think, are just about gone from that game. Like, there used to be aids in the Elder Scrolls games. Now there's, like, I don't know, almost none. Maybe, I think they might have said three. Yeah, I mean, I'll still play Skyrim because I enjoy the world of Elder Scrolls, but I'm not expecting, like a great game, like, as far as RPG mechanics go.
Even Diablo 3, which is all about, you know, like, skills and stuff, it's totally simplified. You know, you can respec at any time. Everything's becoming simple.
One of the complaints I see about Mass Effect 2 is that, you know, like, not only it became more of a shooter, but, like, in a way it was still kind of a crappy shooter. So, like, it isn't like... Well, I haven't played it myself, I have to admit.
I've played it, but I would... like, I'm not one who has played, like, every other great third-person shooter known to man, so I wouldn't really know. But I felt that the shooting in Mass Effect 2 felt fine. It felt serviceable enough.
Yeah, but they're trying to market the game to people who have played every third-person shooter ever made. So, like,
that's where the market is.
Yeah, so like I don't know. Like, I would think that the solution would be to keep the whole like choices aspect of the game, but completely ditch the attributes. The skills or.
Yeah, I think that'd be more interesting from my perspective at least, just to bring in the story elements of RPGs. But I don't know if that would suit what he was defining an RPG as.
Well, yeah, but like the thing is, like the action RPG as we know it now, like it's so much it's becoming less and less of an RPG. So what's the point of calling it that? Make a good action game.
Gabe Newell said that RPG is no longer being a genre nowadays. That it's more of a sauce, as he put it.
Folded into things. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you wanted to go even crazy, you could say that Call of Duty multiplayer is an RPG because you level up and you gain access to perks that give you basically abilities and stat boosts and other things. But yeah.
Did you think Alpha Protocol was worth playing just based on its RPG elements?
It was definitely worth playing for the story. It was really interesting and well done. And
isn't that enough then? Can't you kind of suffer through a little bits of combat?
Well, the thing in that type of game, how I went through it is when you choose three skill trees that you want to specialize in specifically. I always go for stealth. One weapon skill tree, which is always pistol, and then I think it was a sabotage skill tree, which allows you to hack things and pick lock doors just so you can get access to more intel.
I mean, so few games give you that kind of choice that it seems like it might be worth playing just for that, because everything, you can get shooting anywhere.
Yeah, it's the ideal way to play that game, even though it looks like a third-person shooter, the ideal way to play that sort of game is playing it to get the most story and characters out of it. Taking the power route by just shooting every single person inside is, in that sort of games, even if the shooting was, comparable to something like Gears of War or even better, it would still be making you miss out on a lot. Including action RPGs, most of the time it feels based on compromise. You can only get so close to finding a good balance, but you're still gonna annoy some people.
I don't know, as an RPG fan, I feel it's really these RPG elements are not enough, and it's just receiving chicken broth when you want barbecued chicken or something. It's really not.
As an action fan, get those RPG elements the hell out of my action games.
Well, I actually agree. I would love for these action RPGs to turn on the action more and just get those stats out of there. They don't belong there. What are you doing?
My topic is about the necessity of gaming media and game critics and things like that in today's gaming world, which I already said. But essentially, we have the ability to play demos. We have the ability to watch videos. We have a huge interconnected worldwide network with which we can share opinions. As soon as a game comes out, we can get more in-depth opinions than people who play it for review in 3 hours or something than can ever give. We can get them from our friends and people who we know are peers that we know have similar opinions or opposite opinions or whatever. And I just feel in the current gaming environment, I don't know how often you guys actually visit these sites anymore, but I don't really have a need to visit them at all. I mean, there's only so far news that's vetted by the developers and publishers can take you, I mean, when it comes to just a game, ascertaining how good a game is, whether you want to play it or not, I feel like there's so many other better ways to get that. Even podcasts or something like that is sort of a condensed way to get a lot of news at one time and, a little more interesting. I mean, do you guys still visit media websites? Do you feel like they're still essential? And do you feel like instead of reading someone's hands-on preview or something, you would just rather have a demo so you could try it out for yourself and get the same sort of... I mean, that's the best thing of all, right? In terms of trying things out. That was the most difficult thing was trying games out for yourself, because whatever you read, only your own experience with it can define how you feel about it. And now that a lot of games have demos, this is sort of off topic since it's not really a Nintendo thing, but now that a lot of games have demos, you can determine exactly how you feel about it a couple days before the game comes out, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, yeah, you just pointed out the flaw in your argument that I was going to point out. But yeah, we're on a Nintendo podcast here.
But except the Nintendo games, you don't need as much of a demo because, I mean, we pretty much understand what we're getting most of the time, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, sure. But like for third-party games, like you would need demo for a lot of times. And
third-party games on Wii? Oh, wait.
Well, there were at some point.
There were. Monster Hunter had a demo.
It's not really making case for like the need for reviewers because like they were kind of useless when it came to opinions on Wii third-party games.
Exactly, yeah. Since they're just all over the map on every single game, totally.
Well, is there ever a need for critics? Like, I don't know. Like,
Movies, like, there's no way to tell if you're going to enjoy a movie, I think. And maybe critics won't help you either, but it's much, much more difficult, I think, to without playing something. And there's no, like, demos for a movie except for a trailer, which I don't think is the same experience. And I think it's, I mean, maybe it's for, we're educated gamers, so it's a little different, but what do you guys specifically go to these sites for, if you go to these sites still? I'm just curious about that. Like, what do you need them for?
You know, you said that now you get your opinions from like people you trust and friends and family and stuff like that. And that's basically how I treat the sites or the reviewers that I read. You know, like I'm a big fan of what Jeremy Parrish writes. And I feel like I understand his likes and dislikes enough to actually trust him as if like it was like a friend who knew me who was recommending me something. That's basically how I use them. Like I'm not a big fan of Metacritic or, you know, like faceless scores and
it's a bad system.
I think that's the way in which they are still relevant though, because when you take all those individual opinions which nobody cares about and just coalesce them into this big like inhuman mass of, you know, whatever, like it actually
And the unfortunate thing, like as far as Metacritic goes, like that's important as far as determining like how successful critically a game is for someone, for the developers and publishers. When there are very early reviews, those are always because, you know, they give reviewers the opportunity to write about the game on the condition that their score and review for it is a positive one. Because they want to get that high Metacritic rating.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but we can't really... Yeah, like, I don't think that we can actually make that accusation, like, with certainty. Like, I'm sure that there are some cases where it's not true. But I don't know. Like, you said that, like, Metacritic is, like, a good indicator of critical reception, but that's not true. It's just a number that doesn't tell you if like a game is actually like mediocre or polarizing.
I don't think it's a good indicator of critical reception. I just think it's the most important contribution that these reviewers make to the current industry is fueling the like Metacritic beast and like making the hive mind decision.
The bigger flaw behind it is like is that it allows user reviews, really, which kind of like kind of can screw up like a rating for a game even more, especially when you get people who might put a score and not like say anything or any reason behind it.
Yeah,
like that thing that I described is like. That actually happened with like some games like earlier this year, like on XBLA, like Toy Soldiers Cold War. That I was brought up, like there were like, people that just went like onto Metacritic and just like it was like a few people that made just a ton of dummy accounts and just put low scores and put no review text with it, and it got submitted and just started to like tilt the rating lower.
But those are separate from the critic reviews, right?
Yeah, but, like even then, like. That's really still pretty dumb to even allow.
But especially for that game, like, did I miss something? Is that a controversial game? What happened?
It was also Bastion, and it was like there was real no actual like reason. It wasn't like the developers like made anyone mad or anything. It was like just trolls like being trolls.
So Sony Defense Force.
They were doing it for the lulz.
But yeah, like we're not talking about like user reviews anyway. Like we're talking about the critics, and those are separate, as Anand you know, mentioned.
There's some merit to like following a reviewer and knowing what their tastes are, but I almost think in the age of the internet, you can find other people on the internet who could provide you the same service. And I don't know if there's a need for expert gamers, you know? I mean, don't you think their take on games is usually more shallow? But just by definition of having to play through it so quickly and stuff like that, maybe not getting the intricacies of each genre, you know, when they play a game and missing out on a lot of the finer details.
I see a lot of people think that, again, I keep mentioning Giant Bomb or whatever, that's like, as far as like sites with like these sort of critics and reviews and news, like that's really the only one that I go to now. Like I haven't looked at
it. Is it like an aggregating thing? They just aggregate stuff from other places or they make their own?
They make their own stuff. They got Patrick Klepek, who's for their news guy, as well as Alex Navarro and other people at Whiskey Media. But like, you know, like three out of the four main Giant Bomb guys, they're the ones that write reviews. Vinny, he's just like video producer, and he plays whatever he wants on his own time.
Which, I mean, that's the other thing is news, right? Like gaming news, once in a while they break something, when somebody lets something go or when somebody posts something on like LinkedIn. But is there really a need for so many gaming news sites? I mean, are they really contributing anything just by echoing the same things back and forth?
Like, it's very dumb if it's just like, oh, rephrasing a PR announcement, just like just rephrasing or summarizing what it said, is like, that's not very interesting news. But like, news that I think is pretty interesting is kind of like when Patrick Klepek came on to Giant Bomb, who was like a pretty good news writer, apparently. Like, he was like covering the whole like incident at Infinity War and Activision, when, you know, like the two head guys there, that developer studios got booted, and everyone wasn't really sure what was going on, and he was keeping up on the whole thing, making sure he gave updates as it went along. But like, he did like some pretty good stuff. Like, he wrote like an article or two about how like a kid with Asperger's with his experience with L.A. Noire, you know, because you during the interrogations you have to read like people's faces and emotions, and then. And then another one, like, it wasn't from Patrick Klepek, it was like another guy who basically wrote about like his I guess experience and of Dark Souls, which like isn't, I guess, not particularly news or anything. But the part that's kind of nice about that, it is that like, just making your news constantly regurgitated from stuff that everyone else says, yeah, that you're right, that isn't interesting. Like, news,
I mean,
is,
there are some people who do the investigative stuff, and that's interesting, but
the investigative stuff in the summary, I think it still has some worth. It's even more interesting if it's kind of like written personally, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah, like Destructoid or the other one, but I think...
No. I actually read Destructoid, and they're not actually, like, they're news. Like, all they do actually is, like, repost, like, the PR stuff that they receive, but they also,
like
inject...
Same personality, yeah.
They only include lines, you know, like, to say that, just a troll, basically. Like, they want some...
Jim Sterling, that's what you say about Destructoid.
Yeah, but like not just him. Like, I mean, like, they'll always be like, oh yeah, this is why this thing sucks, and like
that's the whole reason for being, isn't it?
It's for page views and clicks, and that's now going to like the dark dark side of the whole idea of video game news on websites, and like doing.
Well,
this
that's
stuff.
The other thing is that a lot of times the internet itself, like message boards, will come up with the news and translate everything, and then these news sites just steal it from there and run with it, you know. Like, a lot of times these days, because people with time on their hands, they're an incredibly powerful force, you know.
Yeah,
they'll always do more than like professionals.
I think as far as content aggregators go, I think Kotaku is one of the worst as far as I've seen, especially like
because
last.
Of a slant,
like,
you mean?
Yeah, like especially when like a lot of it is when it comes down to, hey, here's this cool cosplay that someone made of a video game character. Here's a sentence or two about it. Comment. It's like, really, that's not really news at all.
Well, it's like Charles Dickens, right? They get paid by the post. So, I mean, that informs how the news sites are run, or those sites are run.
Yeah, it's
pretty
like
much, they have like independent people who post, yeah. So they're just always looking for something to put up there.
I know that just a lot of it is, you know, they just gather whatever content they find that is like somewhat relevant to video games and just like slapdashedly just put it up there.
How about like previews? Do you guys think there's any merit? Do you think there's any advantage in having like somebody in the video game media play a game through and then give you his impressions, rather than like if the developers released you the same vertical slice and you could play it for a couple of days or something? Do you think there's any advantage to that?
If the preview was like about a game and they mentioned like there being technical issues or like problems with like what they found in the demo, that would give you an idea of, okay, this game that I'm interested in, it may not be all that if these problems are around. Hopefully, like in the time between this preview event and the release, they'll have time to fix it.
Right, but like, what if you could play some sort of like that same prototype, small slice of the game? Developers might not want you to do that, of course.
Anand, the whole Battlefield 3, like, people were playing the beta and they were asking, like, why is it so crappy? Why is it so bad? And,
And
like, isn't
so
it like a month
close
before
to release
release?
too.
No, it's so close to release. Like, how come it's so bad? And, like, they didn't understand that they were playing a beta, that it was like old code, that like the stuff that the team was trying to test, like, they didn't need to make like a brand new, like, only like recent build for them to play. So, like, people are just too prone to misunderstand what they're playing. Or, like, I'm not saying that reviewers are like these beacons of wisdom, like they know everything about game development, and so, like, they do have like more experience. They perhaps, like, yeah, they're more aware of that what they're playing is unfinished.
Yeah, like that thing that you just brought up about like awareness of like development and stuff and like what the specific things are. I guess like if you want a reason for like why there should still be like the new video game news sites and media, it's so people can like and not only like write about these games or developers, but also like give you it's to give you a better idea of like what is going on behind the scenes, exactly what it is that's making all this happen,
I think that kind of stuff is interesting, but it's pretty rare, right? Like the sort of behind the scenes kind of developer stuff.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, they've also got their contacts and everything. Like, I think that this access that they have is actually an advantage that makes them a more valuable resource than a lot of, message board posts.
That's true, but it
And
comes at a cost, right? The access.
well, sure. Like, there's some stuff that they can't talk about, like NDAs, and there's also, like, perhaps, like, they're making friends and they don't want to say stuff that could hurt them. And
And they have to have a certain tone, like they can't be too dismissive in a preview or something.
yeah, but that's probably a good thing in the end, though.
Well,
No?
that's like, yeah, even then, even if they can't talk about all that stuff, they are still getting to see something that pretty much that none of us here have that opportunity. And if there comes a point where it's like there's something regarding the game industry for them to talk about, like the issue with, if you want to be topical, the issue of like online passes in games like Batman Arkham City and the whole debacle behind that, it's
The
like
kind of thing
talking
that they
about.
never actually bring up in any critical way.
But like when it like outside of the game in question, talking about this specific issue, like that. That's when like the insight that they've earned from getting to see the game behind the scenes, like that's when they can talk about it.
I'm gonna have to start checking Giant Bomb, I guess, because I'm very interested in seeing like an actual like journalist in action. But yeah, like the whole news thing, like I would normally argue like, oh yeah, maybe like these people, since they're so well connected and like it's their job, like they probably can interpret the news better. But when you look at blogs like Kotaku and Destructoid, they jump on sensationalist headlines and like they completely misread the point.
And
Misread the
they
point.
misinterpret stuff all the time.
Oh yeah, like there's a recent story about like the PSP Vita, like the 3G version. Like there's a cap for the downloads, right? And Jim Sterling was just going on about how like stupid it was and how Sony was, fail or whatever. And like it's the same cap that every 3G device has. Like
Sounds
the
insane.
iPhone that he keeps praising has it.
It's jumping on things like firsthand and basically it's a race to be the first one with the news that all the other news sites then have to go to like for that information and
Or
then post
the
it.
first big site with the
That's
news, maybe.
and then that's how it all gets around. Like there's more than likely going to be like one news site that gets it, and then that's more than likely where everyone gets it when they're going to link to like where they got the info from. It's
If
like, oh
they link to it, yeah.
yeah,
That that's the
if they link to it, but in the case of like sites that are courteous and have the decency to give people credit for getting the information in the first place,
I mean, I was
they.
listening to some podcast and they were saying that basically like 90% of the leaks and inside information that you get is just from like some disgruntled employee, like giving out like that's what the
Because at that
investigative
point,
journals
that
almost.
employee doesn't even care anymore.
And like they were saying that's how most of the scoops, get scooped or whatever.
Also, like, what I hate is when blogs just like grab the sensationalist headline and like will pick like one
Excerpts
sentence
one
and
sentence
like
out from an interview,
Yeah, like recently, like there was an Iwata asks about Zelda Skyward Sword, and you know, like tons of interesting information was in that interview, and you know, like 5 years development and what they went through and everything.
And then they take a line out of context and basically just put it out there for everyone to complain about.
Yeah, the headline I read was like, Skyward Sword wasn't originally developed for motion controls, and you know, like
no kidding.
That's all they give. That's all they give, and like the in the comments, the users with themselves in a frenzy, you know, and it's so annoying
because nobody wants to read more into it. Or the famous Iwata versus the entire mobile gaming industry, where the producer of Angry Birds was like, "Fuck Iwata," you know, and like his comment was just taken totally out of context, you know.
Yes.
I mean, but so in the end, you guys do think that they provide a necessary service that helps you, like helps you enjoy games more, or at least
I think it helps, like in my case, especially because, you know, we're going to Giant Bomb, like it's a site run by personalities. I think the personalities behind it makes like the news and the reviews like more interesting instead of like just some guy you probably who you don't even get to know a lot, just like finding whatever news he can and just put it up for everyone
to
see.
Yeah, I think podcasts are a pretty good replacement for like the traditional going to a website or whatever, even if it's kind of biased or whatever. It's at least more entertaining and you can get it at a quicker rate, you know, all collected.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole personalities though thing though, I'm not sure if I like it. Like it's the thing that 1UP used to try to ride on, you know, the 1UP Yours podcast, and basically like later on, like the people who made that podcast admitted that they were playing up the personalities thing, and I don't know, like it's kind of disingenuous. No, like I mean, and like perhaps like they on the podcast they seem to be holding this very strong view against or for this aspect of a game, and turns out that they were doing that for show.
Well, Garnaby always plays devil's advocate, right?
Well, yeah. I think at that point that's like not something that should be completely against having personalities. It's just you should just be honest about it.
Right,
yeah.
You don't have to necessarily force yourself to, you know, behave a certain way.
Yeah, like, you asked, like, if them doing their job was helping us appreciate games more. I wouldn't go that far. Like, I would just say that I think it's probably a good thing that some people with access to these games can talk about them.
But that's the thing, is that the only thing they have over a normal gamer is access. It's just kind of
strange.
Well,
also, like, writing ability sometimes.
Kind of,
writing ability,
that,
come on.
Having that access is still pretty important, I think.
It is important, but if that's the only thing that separates them from us, then often it is. Often they're kind of like more irrational and fanboyish than, I mean, I don't want to paint with a broad stroke here, because of course there are good writers and stuff like that, but are there really that many?
Yeah, I think Jeff Gerstmann would like say differently because he tries not to be so irrational, which make him be all fanboyish, which may make him come off like a jerk or anything, but he's like trying to do his job. Like
He gave Zelda an 8.9, so he's dead to me forever. Or 8.8, something like that.
Oh, sure.
Basically, I'm going to do like we did a couple of times in the first few episodes of the Negative World podcast. I'm going to talk about game design to people who've never designed a game. So, let's talk about game design.
We got to know at least as much as those guys. Come on.
The closest I've done is like made unfinished maps for Team Fortress 2. That's it.
I have hundreds of design documents.
yeah, you've only just gone to like the design document phase. You haven't gone past that.
I can't draw.
All right. But yeah, like the topic came to me by playing Castlevania, of course, because that's basically all I've played in the last 2 weeks. But I was wondering why I as a kid I didn't like Castlevania that much, like besides the brown thing and the general difficulty. Like I'm kind of wondering why as a kid like I couldn't get past the enemy patterns and stuff. And while now I don't really have that much of a problem with it.
Did you play when it came out, or was it primitive when you played it?
Well, no, it was like, I played it around the time that it came out, I guess. But yeah, like I was used to stuff like Super Mario, right? And in Mario Brothers, the enemies always have the same pattern. And I do mean the exact same pattern.
Because it's just walking forward.
And you can control the jumps, right?
That's the simplest pattern in video game history.
Yeah, they just go forward, and like their path is not only predictable, but it's like it's...
Some of them walk off into endless pits. They just walk off to their deaths. So
sure,
sad.
But like I mean, like they're gonna appear exactly always at the same place, and like it's not just like you can almost not call it a pattern. It's just like it's memorized. Like they're gonna trace this route that's never gonna change unless like you block their path or something.
Specifically designed,
Yeah. So like that I don't know, but I think that perhaps like I really like. For some reason, like perhaps my brain is wired to understand these kinds of patterns better. And I really like that. I find that comforting in a game, almost. Because then, like, when you know the exact path that a Goomba is taking, the next time that you're playing, you can jump exactly at the right moment, and you're going to bounce on his head at the exact same moment, or right moment.
And maybe bounce onto Goombas falling behind it, and just get a chain.
Yeah, and but not only that, like, it's just fantastic for, like, speedruns, which I don't do, but, like, if I did, I would choose a game like
Super Mario. Yeah, I don't do speedruns either, but I always enjoy watching them.
Especially
in more modern games where like they're always like trying to find ways to like harder the speed run and they still find a way to break it.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about modern games later, but
even games like Ninja Gaiden though, would you say Ninja Gaiden is like a game like Super Mario Brothers or like Castlevania?
Ah, wow, good question. But actually, no, they do follow the same patterns all
they
the time.
They do, but only when you speed run through it in like a predetermined pattern. Because if you just stand in one place or go back and forth, the enemies will keep multiplying or something, which is essentially kind of the same thing that happens in Castlevania, except for the zombies that come out of the ground.
No, the Castlevania doesn't do the same thing. Like in Ninja Gaiden, the patterns are exactly the same all the time. And like the enemies respawn as soon as they leave the screen. In Castlevania, they don't do that.
And so we're clear what we're talking about. This is the NES Ninja Gaiden.
I
played them, and I can definitely say like the patterns are like always the same until you leave the screen where they're spawned. And
Castlevania has a certain sort of flow to it as long as you go through without stopping, except for the zombies that pop up out of the ground.
I'm not so sure about that though. Like Castlevania actually, like I think the reason why it gave me so much trouble as a kid is because like the damn Fleemen, like they jump around, they will not jump around always. They will not jump around the same way twice.
Fleemen are tough, yeah.
Yeah, so like they vary their attacks, like they vary their patterns. Sometimes they jump low, sometimes they jump high. And
I think
Ghosts
and Goblins is one of the best examples of like, because the way those zombies come out of the ground at just random places.
I was going to mention that game because it's even worse. Like it's the enemies pop out absolutely randomly, and so like you have to be. It's not a matter of memorizing the level anymore. And in Super Mario, that's really what it is. Like you memorize the level. But in a game like Ghouls and Ghosts, it's more demanding on your reflexes.
Right. Well, Mario's about rhythm, they always said, right? Like a rhythm of jumping through the level, and it really is when you play it,
Yeah. Whereas like Ghouls and Ghosts is basically an action game. You have to be on your toes at all times, and it's about combat, right?
Yeah. It's about discontinuity.
The randomization of patterns always makes me think of old arcade games. And like the mentality behind that of, the way arcade games were made difficulty-wise was that to get more money out of you, more quarters. And obviously the way to do that was always to make get you tripped up in different ways.
But I always appreciated that because it makes every game you play feel a little bit different, whereas something like Bit Trip Core or something, the pattern is just ground in stone, and there's not that much ingenuity that you can use.
Yeah, it's all about memorization. But,
yeah, that's kind of annoying when it's just
Which is like I kind of like bet I guess like more in favor for that game like being on a console than it is like in something like an arcade. Another thing I can think about as far as like random AI patterns like in the games today are games that have like an inherent like multiplayer component, you know? Because like
We're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, though.
Gotta stay old school.
I just wanted so we know where we stand, right? Like apparently, I like memorization best. Maybe that's why I like the BitTrip games more than Anand does. And Anand likes the randomness more, and so do you, Alaska Gamer.
I guess I'm kind of in between. It depends on the game, but most of the time, I lean towards the memorization.
And what about like predictable boss patterns?
I think as long as it still requires some sort of physical skill to overcome, it's fine. But if it's like a Zelda game where once you figure it out, it's like just child's play and it's not even fun to execute, then that's no good for me. That's why I like Monster Hunter, because it's pattern-based, but the patterns are kind of switched around, and they have tells, but you don't have that much time to react to them.
Yeah, that's the thing that always makes those quite interesting. Like, going through the different, like, attacks in a cycle, that does make it boring after a while.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, tells are an interesting way that modern games have taken to... because basically, like, the whole... Once the games jumped to the third dimension, like things weren't so simple anymore. Like it wasn't just like Goombas walking forward. Like it didn't make sense anymore in the 3D world.
Lock on combat. Actually, fighting Goombas in like Super Mario 64 is pretty difficult. Like that kick move, it's so hard to get used to. And
because you have to like jump and then like almost immediately press the B button because like that's kind of
jumping on them, which is so easy in 2D, it's like pretty difficult in 3D.
I don't know. I have no problem jumping on Goombas in Mario 64. I don't know what your
problem
is.
Yeah, I don't think it's a. I don't think it's a problem either.
I guess it's just me. Only one of my eyes works.
But yeah, like in that game, actually, like Goombas didn't just walk in a straight line anymore. But
if
you were in their vicinity, if you were close, they would run after you.
Yeah,
but,
that was the change in basically enemy patterns. They just like wandered around. They wandered around aimlessly, and it's only like when you're like in their range, you know, they start moving towards you. You go near a
zombie AI.
You go near a bomb. Its fuse gets lit, and then it chases after you in order to blow up with you.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know what's an interesting example is that in Burnout, remember when they used to have the crash mode in the older Burnout games?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so like they could have done it so that. And actually, the art style Precipice game, it's kind of a score attack game. And because the things are random and it's not the same every time, it totally fails in the score attack for the point based category. Because depending on your first couple of seconds, your ultimate score is going to be totally different, you know? And it's only dependent on that, which sort of spoils it for score attacking. But Burnout 2 and 3, they had traffic intersections where you'd have to cause as much damage as possible. But if they randomized it, and if they had like real traffic, like in Burnout Paradise, then it wouldn't work because then your score wouldn't be really, you know.
Then there's the other sin of making it too predictable, though. Like there's the BitTrip Runner games that have the you can try to score attack BitTrip Runner, but there's a maximum score that you can get in each level, like then the you know like leaderboards would become pointless.
That's actually the thing I don't like about the BitTrip series. Like you were saying, like I really do appreciate the random element, and it feels like if it's just memorization, then where's the game? Like if I can't express myself within the game, then it doesn't feel like as much of a game to me, in a way.
The score aspect, I guess, hasn't like bothered me with those games that much. I kind of like enjoyed it as far as like a challenge of reflexes.
It is still fun like that, unless it becomes, like, if it's just reflexes, like, you can beat it, like, one of your first couple times through, that's fine. But if it's reflexes, like you have to memorize it and then do the reflexes, I don't know. It's a little less gratifying for me.
Well, it's both, though. I mean, like, some levels I managed to beat the first time, you know, like, even get a perfect sometimes. But memorization, I don't know. Like, I still feel it's a game. Maybe you like to express yourself, as you said, but games are also trying to get the optimal route sometimes.
Right. But I mean, that's what I like about like Devil May Cry and those kind of action games that I think you probably don't like as much. Because you can just button mash through them if you want, but you can also have a lot of room for that freedom of expression. Or like Super Mario Sunshine, where there's so many different ways to get to the same point, whereas opposed to in Mario Galaxy, there's usually just one direct way to get there. That's the best way. But in Super Mario Sunshine, there's probably like 10 or 20 ways, you know, that you could do using different things in the environment. And it'd be interesting to see, like, I always bring this up too, but Shiren the Wanderer is kind of an interesting... I think that game is so well balanced because it's almost all random, but there are some elements that are this always the same, and it's always pretty fair and pretty tough, you know? But the more you play, the better you get at dealing with everything, and it's a pretty interesting application of, like, that roguelike kind of random thing to me.
So what do you guys think about games that require actual AI, like first-person shooters or whatever? Like, do you think that is that more rewarding when you beat a game like that? Like, the enemy actually maybe not, like, outwit you, because that's kind of impossible, but, you know, like, they flank you, and, like, you can't predict their patterns because, like, they're going to react to what you're doing.
If you can't predict their patterns, then is it really a pattern?
If the game in question has, like, a multiplayer component where, like, both players can, like, basically do the same things at that the AI theoretically can do, then, when, like, there's, like, no real point in, like, besting an AI in a game like that.
I guess that's the way most people think these days, is that if you can play online, then who cares about the AI in the single campaign? That's why people like Call of Duty, right?
It's not just, like, online, but, like, any sort of, like, any multiplayer in general. Like, trying to, like, practice in a fighting game with the AI set to fight you can be pretty tough, because you have no idea. It has no real set patterns or anything. It's just putting random combos.
It depends on the programming, though, right? I mean, there's a difference between, like, really skillful AI that can just kill you at, like, 100 yards, or, like, a fun AI that's fun to fight against. And I think it really makes a difference.
It's either, like, an AI that is, like, just, like, generated on the fly by the game itself, or it's, like, a specific AI that is designed to replicate the skills of an actual player.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything has to work together. Like, I think like even Doom, even though the AI was pretty stupid, they throw numbers at you in such a big number of them that it's still pretty enjoyable.
And there was, like, a reason to, especially considering, like, you know, there was no looking up and down. You just were always looking forward.
Exactly, these, like, rooms full of huge demons, yeah.
Yeah,
I would still call Doom an old school game, though, because, like, the enemies, they would shoot fireballs at you that you could avoid, you know, and, like, the enemies didn't really have it AI. I mean, like, it was just, like, they were piling monsters and
but you could even utilize the way they moved and stuff to make them shoot each other and things like that. And to yeah, totally. Like, the people that shot fireballs, you could just maneuver it so that they would shoot the people who were approaching you and stuff like that. There's a lot of that stuff in Doom. Because just the numbers, the sheer numbers.
Speed and maneuverability is, like, the big thing about Doom and those very old-school first-person shooters, because things moved a lot faster back then.
Yeah, and, like, I think Halo is probably the best modern AI in terms of just being fun to fight against. I think it's really gratifying when you play Halo at a pretty high difficulty, and I think there's still something to be said for, like, a campaign, like, mode and having good AI, like, fun anime AI to fight against. I think it makes a big difference. That's why Fear is pretty good also.
I still really like predictability and patterns and all of that good stuff. That's probably why I still like 2D games so much and 2D platformers. But I gotta say that games like Kirby Mass Attack was a really refreshing change of pace, because the bosses were actually not like the typical, like, three attacks pattern that you always see in Nintendo bosses.
Right, yeah.
And the rule of three.
Yeah, and you actually needed to whittle down their health.
Health bar.
Yeah, and, like, multiple stages.
Do you guys enjoy modern Zelda bosses? Like, they're nice in terms of spectacle, but I don't enjoy the fights at all anymore, pretty much, with a very few exceptions.
Right. I don't really think that the modern Zelda bosses are really that different from Link to the Past bosses and on. Like, I mean, like, perhaps, like, the first two NES games, the bosses were different. Like, they didn't have such predictable patterns, but since then, like, every Zelda game has been the same, no?
It's not just the patterns, though. It's the difficulty of executing that once you figure out the pattern. That's the problem for me. Like, as long as you still have to roll out of the way with not that much time to spare or something, it's fine. But if it's just, like, so easy, you know? If you have all the time in the world to execute your attack once you figure it out, then...
Especially when, like, the boss doesn't, like, change up its patterns after you, like, deal a blow the first time. Mario Galaxy games, like, in a way, like, did that sets pretty well. Like when you got
those
the
were
bosses.
Good. Yeah,
yeah.
Those bosses were good.
The bosses followed the rule of three, but every time that you like, you know, like you figured out the patterns and then you attack them at the right time, they would like get tougher or faster or more erratic and other things.
Yeah, they just become enraged and
yeah.
It's always fun to look at that animation, except when it's like the 10th time that you see it.
Yeah, because you're trying to beat it on a comment that that says that you have to beat this boss without getting hit.
Yeah.
I think Mega Man games have an interesting sort of boss pattern because they have like patterns and very small tells, but the amount of time you have to react to them is pretty small, I think.
Oh, it's pretty crazy. I just played the Wily's Revenge on the Game Boy. I mean, like the 3DS, like the virtual console. It is tough, and yeah.
When isn't Mega Man tough?
Yeah, basically, if you're not using the right weapon, you're not getting through at all. Like they are brutal.
I just remember playing Mega Man Zero, and like I would fight the boss for the first time. I'd be like, "What the fuck? Are you actually supposed to dodge those attacks?" And then eventually, you're able to, and it's pretty gratifying to do that. But
yeah, it was the same thing with Castlevania. Like at some point, there's kind of a click in your mind, and you get it, and you're like, "Oh yeah." But no, like at some point, like when you beat Dracula, like it was a great fight, and like when I figured out exactly the timing to jump over his fireballs and how to avoid him when he's like teleporting right on top of me.
Did you use the boomerang?
Well, for his second form, but again, like he's pretty, he can be like you basically lure his attacks, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You have to use that to your advantage. So like initially you're perhaps like not going to realize that because you're going to be jumping around like a moron and he's going to shoot his fireballs right at you and you're not going to avoid them because you can't. But, you know, like subsequent times you're going to notice, oh, okay, if I actually stay on the ground, he's going to shoot down so I can jump over them. And yeah, it's very satisfying.
And that's the kind of thing that's totally eliminated from the Metroidvania games because you can just use some combination of skills that makes you basically, you know, invulnerable or something, or potion.
That's not really true. Like the Order of Ecclesia, the last DS game.
Oh, I didn't play that one yet.
You can get medals for beating bosses without getting hit. And basically, like, it's not that fun because I actually tried to do it and I, you know, stopped playing halfway through because it was just too much. But damn it, like half the bosses in the game, I did kill without getting hit after, you know, try after try after try. But yeah, so there is skill involved still. You know, you can do it, but do I recommend it? Not really.
But I think that some of the most interesting games are like when they take very simple patterns and they sort of cross them over with each other at different rates and things like that. So it's kind of complex when you look at it all together, but and it's not totally random, but it's also not totally set in place.
And in modern games, action games like God of War and stuff, like what do you guys think of, like basically the solution that they did find was the whole tell thing, right? And
yeah.
Basically,
like Arkham Asylum?
Yeah, small enemies are basically kind of mini bosses, all of them in a way.
Aren't they just fodder, really?
Well, some of them, but I mean, like, when you get to the Minotaurs in God of War, then you have to react to, you know, different types of attacks. And if you react incorrectly, then you're going to get hit. So in a way, like they're kind of mini bosses, wouldn't you say?
I don't remember that much about God of War. I played a long time ago.
Well, yes, especially they would be considered mini bosses. You know, especially if they're like few and far between. They're like made to like for you to fight at a specific moment.
But yeah, like in a Zelda game, it's always so much more fun to fight the Stealthos knights and things like that than it is to fight just the normal sort of fodder. I kind of wish all the enemies had that level of engagement, which is why I'm looking forward to Skyward Sword. Because, you know, like
the forearm Stealthos and like just to totally like positioning the swords in different ways.
From what I've played of Skyward Sword, like that's probably one of the reasons why the Stealthos was one of the enemies that you played against in the demo, because like it really showed that you couldn't just get by, you know, an autopilot, you know.
It was their way of saying, hey, you can't waggle your way through this.
And then Jimmy Fallon did exactly that on his show.
with a secret. Oops. Jimmy Fallon powers.
Yeah, so basically, like, the game is ruined because all you have to do to beat the game is to invite Jimmy Fallon to play it for you for a couple of, you know, 30 hours.
I can't believe that's coming out so soon. I'm pretty pumped.
Yeah,
there's already the review out. One.
Yes.
Oh yeah, there was today, right?
But we already decided that reviewers were useless and that early reviews were.
I
meaningless.
Didn't.
No, but they have access. They have the one thing that we don't, Guillaume. That's their advantage. And they
well,
used to
I
rule
had
over
access.
Us.
And sometime
that's
in the
true.
future, I'm going to be one of those people in the industry. So just you wait.
One of them, and then you're going to join Goldman Sachs and be on the inside of that too.
I'm going to join the video game industry and get so rich that I'll be swimming in a pool of money, Scrooge McDuck style.
Yeah, I don't think that's how it works, though. I'm pretty sure that those guys.
Whatever. That's just what I keep seeing in my dreams.
I actually felt kind of bad bringing it up because, like, I don't advocate people losing their jobs in general. I'm like the guy who advocates for, you know, like mechanizing farming and stuff like that. But I just wanted to bring it up and see if you guys really thought it was like a necessary thing these days. Like, it used to be totally necessary because we had even less access, right? And no internet.
We've already closed that topic. Though.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm not sure what my final thoughts on this particular topic are, though.
It's okay. We can just ramble for a while. We just rambled for a while.
I guess what this showed is that we just kind of like dissected and looked at different types of AI and what type suits for which games.
But you guys, actually, do you like multiplayer games that much? I mean,
very, very rarely. Like the one I can say that I definitely like, even if I don't play always consistently, is Team Fortress 2.
Because like those games, they actually stop being fun at all when you realize you hop online and you realize, oh crap, I'm terrible at this game. And everyone else is just a god.
That's why I like Team Fortress 2 so much, because every time I do come back to it, I feel like I can still hold my own as a scout with my same loadout of weapons.
Because
like the thing that I can at least get away with scout is because they're so weak that they are basically meant to be fodder for the team, and I'm fine with that because I still die in other multiplayer games regardless.
I think online games are just punishing. It's just like punishing for your psyche and your soul.
That's where I find solace in not being able to kill the other team.
That's why I like I think the online games I still enjoy are the ones that are fun, regardless of whether you win or lose, which is not that many of them. You know, but a lot of Nintendo games are like that.
Yeah.
Like Smash Brothers or something.
And co-op, in a lot of ways, when you think about it, is a lot more appealing than the competitive type of multiplayer. Because you're playing
well, for some people.
Yeah, like, but in my case, you know, it's a lot more fun to play with someone towards a common goal than like try and like play against someone. Because I've had experiences like that with friends in the past who have like spent way more time with the game than I have, and it's like seriously,
that's what you have to tell yourself after you play Call of Duty, right? You're like, these guys probably spent all their day just playing Call of Duty.
No, it's not even Call of Duty. It's been like games that I remember like playing back in elementary, like Smash Brothers. Like pretty much all the people that I played it with just kept beating me.
That's no fun. But yeah. the whole co-op thing, like it depends who you are and how good you are at these games. Because recently I went back to Left 4 Dead 2, and I tried to play co-op with new people, and you know, like they kept shooting at me, so by accident, but still.
They probably weren't doing it on purpose. Yeah, that's so embarrassing,
that's why,
isn't it?
That's why you always need to play with friends. Play with someone you know.
Yeah, they were negative world people.
I played.
You want to name names?
I played Portal 2 co-op like with Chainsaw Leon from IGN. It's like one of the few like good people left in the IGN like Wii lobby. He liked Portal. I liked Portal, and so we decided to play the Portal 2 co-op over the summer.
Portal's not even like there's no violence. There's no there's not really anything to get good at. It's just puzzles.
Even then, like it's still like working towards a common goal, and it's solving those puzzles.
Yeah, I feel it's different though. I mean,
it's still cooperating.
Doesn't one person usually figure everything out?
Well, like my friend and I took turns basically figuring things out. Like I'm pretty sure that neither of us feels stupider than the other.
It was like a few times we just overcomplicated some of the puzzles. Like we tried to come up with like weird like sort of like combinations of portals to make it so like I hit a button and as soon as I hit the button he flings through a portal and pushes me to a door that closes like 2 seconds after or something like that. But then we realized we just like fling a box on the button and then we go through.
That's the other thing with co-op, though. It's like he was saying, shooting your own teammate. If you're actually the person who's doing like the teammate shooting, it's so embarrassing. It's like being on the football team and you fuck up and everyone's like, "What are you doing?" Like that's why I hate team sports, like in general.
Yeah, that is kind of the same thing I've had, you know. But yeah, like I'm definitely not fond of team sports, but I'm fine with like sort of like team games.
Team
so long
virtual
as, like,
sports.
But not so much that, but like so long as you aren't like left overly reliant on the other person in order to be successful. I mean, like that. I mean, that kind of like sounds like how it would be in Portal 2, but like it didn't feel like that when I played it.
Yeah, as long as if you're playing with someone at the same skill level, like everything is more fun. Co-op is more fun. Adversarial stuff is more fun. It's always fun.
Like, absolutely. That was the problem that I had when I was younger when I played multiplayer games, because everyone else like spent way too much time on the same game when I played a whole bunch of other games and just kept getting destroyed.
But yeah, the whole getting better at the same time thing, like it's absolutely important to enjoy co-op and adversarial, I guess, games. Like,
counter up.
Otherwise, like if it's too one-sided, like the person who's too good at the game is going to get bored, and you know the other person's just going to get frustrated.
Yeah, that's why I always advise people not to play together in Monster Hunter if they're too far apart, because it's just no fun for the lower people. And you know, like back in college and stuff, I used to play Tekken, you know, and it's I used to play my roommates and that kind of stuff and do time trials and stuff, and it was really fun because we're all at the same level. But like when you jump online, it's just like, fuck this, you know.
Thank you for listening to the Negative World Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please like us on iTunes. You know, it's okay to like us in real life, but we also need your digital likes on Facebook and all that good stuff. And turns out that you don't even have, if you have an iPhone, like you don't even have to go on iTunes or anything to like us. Like you can just do it right there.
You don't even have to listen.
Well, yeah. You don't even have to listen to us. Just download the thing and then like click on the links on Facebook and like share the link to your friends there, and it's gonna be awesome. Also you can come over to negativeworld.org if you want to talk to us about game design and Giant Bomb and all that good stuff. And just look for the negative.org page on Facebook if you're too shy to talk to us on the board itself, but you're strangely okay with you know, showing us your real identity on Facebook. And also, you can also look us up on Twitter. It's negative_world. And yeah, like a few things that I want to mention. Like we talked a lot about Castlevania in this episode. Go check out the reviews of Sir Baster Sephiroth. He's written like volumes about each Metroidvania game that came out on the GBA and the DS. And I encourage you to read them. They're full of interesting facts. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Thanks for listening.
And let's all
Thank
say big
guys.
Happy birthday to Alaska Gamer. Big ups to Alaska Gamer on his birthday, 18th birthday. Woo-hoo!
Yeah, we already mentioned that, but happy birthday again. but yeah, and thank you guys for being here, you know, talking at people.
Thank you.
It was nice. It was
Thank
nice
you for letting us
again.
Talk at you.
Yeah, it was awesome.
And talk over each other.
Yes.
Yeah, it's going to be a nightmare to edit. Yeah, thank you for listening, and see you in 2 weeks.
See ya, not in 2 weeks.
See you how many other months it is until I'm back on here again, if ever.
Awesome. Do you guys want to get started?
Okay.
Sure. All right.
I've had enough. I'm
okay,
sorry.
Okay. Let's do this.
That was enough small talk. But yeah, speaking of passive aggressive, you two guys are probably the two people who like to talk over other people the most that I've had on the podcast. So
this
I only
is the
ask,
disclaimer section.
That's
yeah,
just aggressive.
Yeah, sure. No, I just ask like one thing of you. Don't make the universe implode.
Okay.
I think we'd get in trouble.
We'll suck up 90% of the bandwidth.
We'll, see, exactly. We'll, this is what I was talking about.
Darn
right
it! Can't help it.
Continue. I didn't get to make my joke. Okay, go ahead.
All right, I'm back.
All right.
What time is it for you right now? Is it like 5? 5:20?
6:20.
6:20?
Really? That's early. What time is it for you, Guillaume? 10:20 or something?
Yep. It's yeah, good. Better finish it up. Okay. I'm getting tired. So you guys...
I wish my topic was less dry. I should have picked like a Wind Waker bash topic or something like that.
Nice. Cool.
You, man. Wind Waker's awesome.
Oh, I would have done it. I should have done it. Anyway, go ahead.
All right. So yeah, like my topic... Oh. Sorry, what?
I was saying to Anna, I can't, what? Come at me, bro.
No.
Like,
where does that come from?
I don't know, like, what the exact origin of it is, but I just, like, the thing I most
the
remember.
The internet.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the thing I most remember for is, like, being part of, like the caption on a picture of, like, an anteater with, like, his arms all stretched out, like, that fits with the phrase, come at me, bro.
It's got to come from something. Some,
hang in
some,
there, baby. Everything comes from something, but is it even known?
Yeah, I don't know. TV tropes or something? Well, no.
Yeah, that's true.
Or know your memes.
No, we better not go to TV tropes. We will never come out alive. We'll just
that's Urban forever. Dictionary, man.
Oh, yeah. All right, so, any final thoughts or...
I'm hungry.
Okay. My brain's empty.
Oh, awesome. Finally.
Finally. I'm tired.
That was the plan all along.
Don't you think, like, whenever people talk for more than 3 minutes about one game on a podcast, you're just, like, you just tune out?